Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for November 15th, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, joining you from the road on I-75. I don't know that I've ever done a Kudzu Vine driving since 2007, but I'm going to try it, so hopefully it'll be smooth. Joining me gladly working the board tonight, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir, and yes, you have done a Kudzu Vine from the road driving.
I know I've done them for the road, but usually my wife's driving, but I'm by myself, so I don't have a Google car, so I got to kind of take the wheel on this one. And welcome, Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
Yes, I'll be passing by. I'll give it 30 minutes, Catherine. I'm just entering Cobb County. Well, let's go ahead and open the show, and it seems like there's no other way to open this show than talking about the terrorist attack in Paris. Now, we don't want to be brazen and talk politics about what affects American politics or anything else, but just a horrific tragedy, and I guess our thoughts and best wishes go out to all the people affected in Paris, and really, I guess, throughout the world, because people were visiting or living overseas in Paris. It wasn't just French citizens. It's something that really seems to have affected people across the world. Obviously, in Europe, it's going to affect, but it seems to have crossed over across the ocean, and it kind of just reminds us of what happened in New York in September of 2011. Catherine, what are some of your thoughts on it?
Well, I think the other thing is that anyone who's ever been to Paris, as I have several times, loves the city. I mean, I love that city, and I think anyone who's been there has most people who've been there have a special attachment to it like I do, and so I think it's always very sad when something that is, you know, close to you and means so much is under attack like it was. So I think it has a special place in many, many people's hearts, and so I think that's part of the reason that it's so devastating. And my, thoughts go out to everyone who's traveling. I had several friends who were traveling there on Friday or have arrived there now or are going next week. So, strength to everyone and may peace prevail as we go forward.
Yes, Tim?
Yeah, I've like to echo a lot of what Catherine said, and I, too, have a couple of friends that were on their way over there, one via a ship, actually, and of course, just want to send a shout-out to those folks and to be safe, and to all the people of France. Our hearts really do go out to you. Terrorism knows no borders, and it has no conscience to speak of, and it's just a very, very sad situation, and it's a fact of life now, and the modern world, especially with the advent of mass communications, where it can be seen immediately by everyone in their living room, and it's just really a sad thing. Our hearts really do go out to those folks over there. And David, I'm glad we're not going to be discussing any political implications of it. I just think it's way too soon for anyone to be talking about that. And I hope at the national level, all these folks running for office try to keep the same outlook if possible. So that's really about all I have to say about it.
Yes, I think there's only one political comment that's appropriate this time, and terrorism makes you understand how wonderful democracy is because it's a peaceful way to express your views and no one is harmed or killed. Everyone can still live when people cast ballots for the direction of our country and world instead of take up arms. And so I think that's one thing terrorism does. It makes us appreciate democracy and wonder why we can't have that 24/7 all across the globe. But I guess that's the only appropriate political comment I think I could see making at this point. Well, not to be trivial, just 5 minutes later, but we'll start into some other topics. Before I did neglect to ask or add, coming up in about 15 minutes now, Dr. John Sides, the creator of the Monkey Cage blog, professor at George Washington University, and he's also been a guest a few times on the Kudzu Vine. He's not been on in a while, but was quick to agree to come on, and we're just glad to have Dr. Sides on in just a little bit to discuss political matters of the day. But, Tim, since I'm on the road, you're picking topics. You lead us.
Well, let's just start with the good old state of Georgia and right down there where Catherine is. There's a story that's hit the airwaves in the last couple of days that an old friend of the Kudzu Vine that's been on here with us, Senator Vincent Ford, is considering running for mayor in 2017. When our current mayor's term limited out, he's a good man, and he would start with a base and name recognition, but it's going to be a crowded field, though, down there, isn't it, Catherine?
Yes. I mean, we already have two declared, three with Senator Fort. So we have State Representative Margaret Kaiser has announced that she's running. Former Atlanta City Council President Kathy Woolard has announced that she's going to be running for mayor. And then now we have Vincent Fort, Senator Vincent Fort, State Senator Vincent Fort. And I think there's probably at least three more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not gonna say any names because I'd just as soon we keep the field small, but and I think the other person that I'm not going to say any names, but it's going to be an interesting race. I'm ambivalent about running for 2 years. I mean, this is kind of ridiculous if you ask me. You know, we've got a big election year ahead of us, and I don't really want to be forced to be distracted from the presidential and the state races and all that other stuff because of this mayor's race. But, you know, they didn't ask me before they decided to declare.
Well, that, yeah.
I think Senator Ford has a I'm a big fan of his. He has done some things in the past that have made me very angry, mostly inter-party behavior, and I have had a little chat with him about that and hope to have a chance to have a longer discussion with him about that. But, you know, he actually said to me, the worst politics are family politics, then church politics, then inter-party politics, and then real politics. So I thought that was pretty clever and pretty accurate, honestly. So I'm not big. I don't know much about church politics, but I think he does have some bridges to mend. But I think he's capable of it, and I know he has like a very progressive agenda ahead of on his mind. We can always trust that. So we'll see.
Yeah, David, Catherine, my question here about this would be, it doesn't seem like any of the three in the field, now I may be naive to this, not being an Atlanta citizen, but none of those three seem to be the Kasim Reed legacy candidate. Is there going to be one of those, or is one of these three that, and I just didn't know?
I don't think, certainly not Senator Ford. And, yeah, I wouldn't say Kathy Woolard, considering some of her recent comments. I don't know what his relationship is with Margaret Kaiser. I'm not sure. I don't know much about that. I'm not sure that anybody's going to want to be closely attached to the mayor as he's leaving office. I'm not saying that as a dig on him. I'm just not sure that that's going to be the most politically savvy situation for a candidate.
Well, when he leaves office, what's he going to do? Reed, Mayor Reed, what's he going to do?
He says he's got, I remember he was quoted as saying he's got one more election in him, but that for the immediate future, he's going to go to the private sector and make some money to save some, to pack away some money for his children's education.
Catherine, tell us from the outside, I don't see, why Mayor Reed would be that controversial. What inside the city are his detractors saying? I mean, what might make him unpopular?
Well, he's quite unpopular. He's got he's got a hair trigger temper. He's constantly, blocking people on Twitter anytime anybody criticizes him for even the most minor infractions. He sort of reacts in a way that isn't very attractive. Just recently, in my neighborhood, there's been for like the last 15 years, they've been trying to redo a whole area by extending a road from, like, it's a big shopping center, and they want to extend a road across that shopping center so that it connects with a major road. And then there's like a Publix and a bunch of other, like a mixed use development that there's developers that are willing to do it, but they will only do it if they can extend this road. And he just vetoed it the other day. And this has been in the works for over a decade. And the people in that neighborhood, I don't quite understand the development. I don't see why they need that road, but I'm not a developer. I don't know all the ins and outs. But people were very upset about it. It wasn't even a lot of money. It was less than $1 million, which is a lot of money, but in the scheme of the city of Atlanta budget, it's not that much. And then people are not real happy, like with things like the streetcar, some of the other more visible things. I think the the Turner Field deal is not generating a lot of support for him. Even though that deal isn't done yet, but I think there's the visuals on it are not particularly good for him. Same with the Falcon Stadium. I think there was some feeling that there was a lot of, sort of back room dealing. I'm not saying there was, but I think that was the visual on it. So, I think he's been an effective mayor, but I would not say he's very popular.
Well, let me ask you this question, and then I'll let Tim ask some questions. He has some. Would you say that Kasim Reed is probably more popular in metro Atlanta, outside of the city of Atlanta, where people aren't voting for him, but what he does affects them, than he is inside the city residents?
I think that might be the case, but I think it's a very narrow, you get to the suburbs and he's, maybe more popular for some reasons. But once you get outside of that into sort of the exurban and rural, I think he's not very well liked. That's why
they would vote for him on a ballot for governor. I just mean I like him better than I'd like Vincent Ford or something. You know what I'm saying? Just like he's perceived better.
Well, I think one of the other problems is that he followed a very, very popular mayor. Shirley Franklin was very cordial and very popular, and got a lot of work, got a lot done, and was not, she rolled with the punches. She worked really hard for the city and, you know, was recognized nationally as a great mayor. And so I think that the counterpoint to Mayor Reed, and I, let me just say, I think he's done a pretty good job as mayor. There's some things that I don't agree with him on, but it's a big juggling act in the city of Atlanta. But I do think that his sort of arrogance and his temper have not served him well. The appearance of arrogance. Mm. I'm not saying he's arrogant. I think he appears to be. You know, things like getting his car, you know, parking on 10th, in the middle of 10th Street and getting your car booted in the middle of the day doesn't reflect well on as the mayor. You know, like parking in a no parking zone, blocking a cycling lane, and you know, getting your car booted is just so you can run in and get lunch. I think that's the kind of thing that you know you don't want your mayor to do. Right? I mean, and those things, they may seem very minor, and they are. They're like, what's the big deal? It's a minor infraction. You know, just move on. But people remember those things, and they convey an image of arrogance and lack of respect for everyone, for the rules that everyone else has to follow.
Well, let me ask both of you a question. Catherine alluded to this earlier, that these things seem to be starting earlier and earlier and earlier. Why are political campaigns doing that now, even down to mayoral races?
I think there's two reasons. One, money is so critical in all levels of politics, and therefore you have to start raising it and start having to build your infrastructure. And so, therefore, you got to get started to raise the money. Secondly, you know, the three people now running for mayor and anybody else thinking about it, they care more about their mayoral race than they do the presidential election because their name's on the ballot. And, therefore, they're thinking about it because it affects them more than who the president is affects them. It's not about us. It's about them and looking out for their self-interest. And I'm not saying they're wrong to do that. But I'm just – those are the two reasons I see. Catherine, you may have others.
Well, I think that's kind of a – I mean, I think you're right, but I think it's kind of a what's the word I'm looking for?
Narcissistic?
It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that, oh, I need money to run a campaign, so I better start raising money now, and I'm going to have to – so – if you start a year early, then you're going to need more money than you would if you started a year from now or 8 months from now or whatever. You know what I mean? So yeah, if you start in 2015 to run in 2017, you're going to need a lot more money than if you started in 2016.
Well, she makes a good point. You can start raising money without officially announcing. Why are these people already announcing?
Could be trying to lock up endorsements or support as well. Although, now, one thing I will say is when you raise money, a lot of times you hire a fundraiser and maybe a campaign strategist and like one other person, somebody to kind of work in the office. You run an office and not the best, most glamorous part of town, maybe a lawyer friend donates it to you, the space. You keep your burn rate super, super low because you're not going on TV and radio. And therefore, you're usually raising a ton of money and spending very little early on. It's that last, 2 to 3 months of your campaign where you spend, 70% of cash. It's kind of
right. No, I know what you're saying. I just think it's a little bit, and I don't disagree with you. I think that is one of the intentions and one of the reasons that people start early. But I think it's kind of funny. But the other thing is, I think,
like less money in politics. I mean, I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying it's what it is. It's like, sports teams, they practice too much. But if you don't practice as much as the other team, you get behind. Because of the other person doing it, you got to do it. And it's the same thing in politics. I don't want to raise this money, but so-and-so is going to raise this money, and I'll lose if I don't. And you're just stuck in the game.
Yeah.
The other thing, one of the other reasons I think they declare early is to try to keep the field clear. So if, three candidates are in the race,
point.
And
when
they –
when a power name does it, yeah.
Right. Doesn't always work.
We are still waiting on our guests to call in. And while we're doing it, we're going to go ahead and start another topic. And I might have to interrupt you at any time, but we'll just get to that when we get to it. Matt Towery over at Insider Advantage commissioned a poll of Georgia of the state of the Republican race here at present. And here's where it stands. Dr. Carson has 26.3%. Donald Trump has 24. And with that, I'm going to stop. David, I believe our guest is with us.
All right. Well, welcome back to the Kudzu Vine, Dr. John Sides of George Washington University and the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, thank glad you could come back on. It's been a little while, but glad to have you. And Dr. Sides, since we had you on last, you have obviously published, I think you were in the process of publishing some chapters. You fully published the book The Gamble, which I think was one of the top books about the 2012 election, and also your blog, The Monkey Cage, was an independent blog at the time, and now it has moved over and is part of the Washington Post. Tell us about that transition.
Well, we had a couple of offers over the last few years to move inside a larger media publication, and one of those offers was attractive to us, and so I started asking around with colleagues and friends who work for the media, kind of what their advice would be. And one of those conversations led to a second conversation with the Washington Post. At that point in time, they seemed to be building out a little bit of their sort of academic contributions, and they did that by bringing us on board and bringing one of the more well-known legal blogs on board, which is run by a group of law professors. And they were talking to some other academics in other areas like healthcare and economics. And I think that, what we were able to do with the move to the Post is twofold. One is to obviously broaden our audience significantly. There's just no doubt that being part of the Washington Post gives us a much larger reach than we had before, just in terms of the number of people that come to the site and the number of people who read what we do. And the second thing is that I think in part because the Washington Post offers that opportunity, we have had a lot more political scientists come to us interested in writing about, whatever's in the news. And so we're able to feature a much more diverse amount of scholarship and perspectives on anything ranging from the American presidential election to events across the world. So for example, with regard, to the terrorist attacks in Paris, we are going to be able to have probably, five or six or eight different pieces of content written by scholars who have all kinds of expertise about ISIS or Muslims in Europe or Muslims in France. And so we're able to draw on all that. So that's really been a huge and somewhat unexpected effect of being at the Washington Post.
Yes, I'm not sure of the exact timeline, but it seems about the time that the writer of The Fix, Ezra Klein, left the Washington Post, y'all kind of came in. There may have been some overlap while y'all are there together, but that was kind of a void the Washington Post had, and you, in many ways, filled it. Y'all see that, or is that something I'm seeing?
I think that because of Ezra Klein and, some other folks, there's just a much broader reach of political science in general. I think Ezra brought that to Wonk Blog, and I think the Wonk Blog that continues at the Washington Post, even after Ezra has left, continues that. Of course, Ezra continues that at Vox, his news site. And, in some sense, we've been doing this since 2007, and I think one of the upsides of doing it is that I don't think we've made ourselves obsolete yet, but it's definitely the case now that I feel a little bit of pressure to write and report on political science research or new political science research before, one of these other sites gets its hands on it and does it first. And so in some sense, that's a nice place to be in where you know, the work that we've done over the years and trying to promote this research is now led others to go out and look for that research themselves without having to be prodded by us first.
Yes, it makes total sense. I'm going to pass it along to Tim. Tim, questions for Dr. Sides on any political happenings today.
Yes, sir, and welcome again to the Kudzu Vine, Dr. Sides. We'll just jump right into some political questions now. There are still 15 candidates in the Republican presidential field. I don't know if the guys are trying to have a football team or what they're trying to do here, but how many of these would you rate as serious? And by serious, I mean frontline people who realistically could garner the nomination.
That's a good question. You know, looking at one interesting piece of data, which is the prediction markets. You know, there are these places out there where you can bet money on who's going to become the Republican nominee and who's going to become the next president and a variety of other things. There's nothing magical about these markets, but they're useful for distilling lots of different information. And I think that the people who participate in these markets, who are betting, you know, betting their own money, which is not me, by the way, but who are betting their own money, they have an interest, I think, in behaving at least somewhat sensibly, you know, and not reacting to just whatever is making cable news pundits salivate that day. So, you know, you look at that right now and you see Marco Rubio has about a 48, sort of an estimated 48% chance of winning. And then, you know, trailing relatively far behind him, you know, is Donald Trump at 19% and Ted Cruz at 13% and Jeb Bush at 10%. And everybody else is in the single digits if they're, you know, if there's any chance at all. So from that, you know, I think you would say that, you know, Rubio is at the moment somewhat dominant. Bush obviously has lost a lot of ground, but for quite a while he was the leader in these markets. So, you know, Trump and Ted Cruz are the two others. So, you know, most people, I think this has been true of Trump all along, is that his position in these betting markets has always been below his polling numbers. And I think people mm-hmm. tend to sense that his polling numbers are in some sense either, you know, somewhat inflated. Maybe they're inflated by news coverage, you know, just whoever gets the most coverage happens to do a little bit better in the polls. Or mm-hmm. people look at his poll numbers and say, you know, lots of candidates lead the polls several months before the actual primaries begin. What's the real chance that this guy can win once we have to go to Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and Florida and all these places? With
right.
Cruz, I think the story is somewhat different. There is just a question of, is someone that is as strongly conservative as he is really able to win the support of a broad enough swath of the party? So I think, you know, those are both important questions. So that leaves Rubio, I think, as the candidate that right now seems to be the most likely to unify the party. And by unify, I don't mean that everybody thinks he's the best or the greatest. I just mean to think that, you know, I just mean that he's at least satisfactory to enough factions within the party that he's able to win the nomination. You know, at Bush at 10%, you know, frankly, at 10%, I'm buying on Bush. I mean, if I were to go out and spend some money, I think he's probably
mm-hmm.
He's a little bit undervalued, and you could see circumstances under which, if some other candidates, you know, eventually flame out, you know, he's able to have a bit of a resurgence. I wouldn't say that's a likely prospect, but, you know, maybe again, 10% seems a little bit unlikely.
That's
a couple of thoughts about the race, but I have to say, you know, I don't have a lot of real confident or strong beliefs about this, or I'd be in there trying to make a lot of money.
yep.
You know,
but there's an interesting thing, Doctor. There was a name you did not mention.
Yeah, I noticed
and
that.
That's Dr. Carson's name, who is the present front runner. What gives there?
I mean, I think, you know, certainly if you look at the Iowa polls, he's the front runner, and if you look at the national polls, he's in second place. You know, with Carson, again, I tend to see a candidate that's somewhat factional in nature. I mean, I think his appeal is he's certainly broadly liked within the party. And I think that reflects people's respect for his biography and his
mm-hmm.
accomplishments as a doctor. And I think it reflects, the fact that he seems to have a fairly, genial persona. He's not the kind of polarizing figure that someone like Trump is.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, in some sense, similar to Cruz, his views on lots of issues really don't put him fairly far from the mainstream of public opinion. And it's a very risky nomination, right? I mean, it's not that under certain conditions he couldn't win the presidency. It's just to say that if the Republicans were to nominate a candidate like Carson, they're probably, handicapping themselves a little bit relative to nominating maybe a candidate like Rubio or Bush. And so for that reason, I tend to see the Carson phenomenon is inevitably somewhat limited in its reach. It's hard for me to imagine him winning, primary after primary or actually piling up enough delegates to win the nomination at the end of the day. It's not to say that he hasn't made his mark in this race.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just to say that, again, I don't see any reason. I mean, I'm looking at the prediction market now, and he's down at 6%.
Wow.
I'm not buying at 6%.
Wow.
I could even make a persuasive case for selling at 6%. So in my mind, I think that he has, some more significant challenges that will eventually confront him.
All right. Well, with that, I am going to pass it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Hey, Dr. Seitz, thanks so much for being on. We really appreciate it. It's nice to have a little intellectual perspective on some of these things. My question is about, and I think it plays into what Tim was asking about, and having just watched the Democratic debate last night and watching as much of the Republican debates as I can stomach, which is about a half of them, about half of each debate, and then I just have to change the channel to something more entertaining. But I've never really bought into this likability factor. I've always thought, well, who cares if you want to go have a beer with the president, right? I mean, it doesn't really mean much to me. But I think, and what you were saying, I think that of the candidates that are the Republican candidates, I think Marco Rubio is the most likable of the bunch, maybe John Kasich to a lesser extent. And so I'm just wondering if you have thought at all about that. I think Ben Carson is a likable guy too, but I think the rest of them are a little. I mean, I think that the rub on Ted Cruz is that everybody says no, that he's just not a very nice guy. Like, you hear that from inside the party that, nobody really likes him, that nobody wants to go out and have a beer with Ted Cruz. But so, and I think that on the Democratic side, I think that's the only reason that Martin O'Malley is still in there is that I think he is, of the three, the most likable. So have you thought at all about that? And does that affect these elections, do you think?
When we get past the nomination phase and we're looking at the general election, I tend to be a little bit skeptical that factors like likability matter. It's only because, you'll always be shocked to hear this. There's a striking tendency for Democrats to like Democratic candidates more than they like Republican candidates and vice versa. And so it's a little hard to know what the chicken and what the egg is there. But when we're looking at the nomination contest and we're trying to think about, what is it that's going to persuade a relatively broad swath of the party, including not just Republican voters, but Republican Party leaders of various kinds, what's going to persuade them to support a particular candidate? It's not inconceivable to me that something like likability matters, and in particular that people, sort of relatively sophisticated observers in the party are looking and thinking about, which of these candidates is going to be able to make a favorable impression when they have to compete against Hillary Clinton or whoever the Democratic nominee is. And, I think if you look at voters' assessments of Rubio, in the most recent Washington Post poll, 41% had a favorable view, 37% had an unfavorable view, and 22% didn't have any opinion yet. He's not well known as some of the other candidates. So he's slightly more liked than disliked, which contrasts pretty sharply with Jeb Bush, and contrasts equally sharply with Cruz and Trump. And so, you know, if you're thinking about putting forward a candidate that's not already in some, you know, somewhat held in sort of mixed regard by the public, you know, certainly we'd be able to expect it than the alternatives. You know, Cruz, I think the challenge for Cruz is that he's built his whole political reputation on you know, what he would sort of consider speaking truth to power and being an antagonist, not just of Democrats, but of his fellow Republicans.
Right.
He's never tried to make friends in the Senate. And I think that's, I've always thought that poses challenges to him. You know, you need the support of your colleagues. You need the support of party leaders, I think, to be able to improve your chances of winning. And I think it's just tougher for...
Well, and to get anything done. I mean,
yeah, well,
running for president, but just to get things done in the Senate.
Absolutely, and that's not the game he plays. You know, and so, I just think that there's clearly a strategy in which that might work to influence events in the Senate, but it's not necessarily a strategy that works for the long run in terms of increasing your chances of winning the Republican nomination for president.
Okay, I'm going to send it back to David. Thank you.
Yes, well, Dr. Sides, this past week, there was kind of a strange question that got asked to multiple candidates. I don't know if it was asked of all of them, but I know it was asked of Joe Bush. It was asked of Ben Carson. And it was about, would you go back in time if you could and, you know, assassinate Adolf Hitler or kill him as a baby or abort him and all these different iterations of the same question. Where in the world do our politics get down to the point where this kind of question is being asked of so many candidates and almost has become some kind of litmus test in the Republican presidential race so far?
I agree that it's a strange question, and it's not really a very helpful or very useful question. My interpretation of that question has just been in some sense people are trying to push the Republican candidate to see if there's any circumstance, you know, under which they would favor, you know, a version of abortion, right? I mean, you know, obviously you wouldn't kill, I mean, killing a baby is not, you know, infanticide is not necessarily abortion in the minds of some. But that's what they're essentially trying to do. You know, I don't think it's a helpful question. I think it's gimmicky, and it invites a sort of a level of snarkiness and non-seriousness that doesn't help. I think underlying the question is a valuable idea, which is to say, take a contentious issue like abortion. It's easy to make that issue seem like it's sort of black and white, or it's, and maybe better color metaphor is it's red and blue, and either you're in the pro-life camp or the pro-choice camp. In actuality, a lot of the public is sort of in kind of a mushy middle. You know, they will approve of abortion in the first trimester, but not necessarily the second or third trimesters. They'll approve of abortion under some circumstances, such as cases of rape and incest, but, you know, they're not necessarily going to favor abortion under any circumstance. So I think it's valuable to try to figure out kind of where leaders draw these boundaries. And it's been interesting in the Republican race so far because at least, you know, even candidates like Rubio seem to have, at least in one of the debates, staked out a fairly, you know, strongly conservative position, even with regard to situations of rape and incest, that's really not in the mainstream of public opinion. I mean, the vast majority of people, 85% or, you know, even 90%, support abortion under those cases. So, you know, and you could imagine similar questions of Democratic candidates. You know, are there cases under which abortion would not be allowed? You know, what if the mother just and father decide they don't want to have a boy, they want to have a girl? You know, if you had abortion for cases of sex selection or something like that. I can tell you from survey research that the vast majority of the public does not support abortion under that circumstance. So it's useful to try to figure out where politicians' boundaries are, and it makes them think more specifically about the issue rather than just give us, you know, kind of broad rhetoric or what have you. However, I think reading Adolf Hitler into it isn't really advancing our discourse all that much.
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Tim and then around to Catherine like that. Tim?
Yes, sir. I would like to talk a little bit about Jeb Bush because, like so many, I've been scratching my head about him and his campaign. Now they consistently say, you know, that their organization is going to eclipse that of other candidates in the long run. They say they have more money. They said they have more volunteers and paid staff in the field. They say they are out in all of these states. They said they've got a great TV ad campaign ready to go that will eclipse the other candidates. That's always been one of their ace cards. But can they outlast the field if their candidate does not start connecting with the voters, which he just simply does not seem to be doing?
I mean, I think you put the finger on your finger on exactly what Bush's challenge is. You know, and I'm of two minds here. You know, on the one hand, all of the things that you just mentioned, organization, money, staff, you know, I think these things matter. I think being able to build the infrastructure of a real campaign is almost a necessary condition for being able to fight a primary battle across time, right, maybe over 2 to 3 months, and across lots of different states. You know, just focusing all your energy on Iowa and being able to win Iowa doesn't necessarily give you much in terms of winning the states to come after, ask, I don't know, Mike Huckabee or Rick Santorum. But so I think those things are good. And when I listen to the Bush people talk, I think to myself, okay, you know, they're playing the long game. They're not getting caught up in polls 3 months before or 4 months before the actual primaries begin. I think all that's sensible, right? Like that shows to me a sort of a maturity of sorts in their thinking. Now, on the other hand, I think that Bush has had serious problems not only connecting with, you know, Republican primary voters overall, but really, you know, improving himself to Republican Party leaders, you know, at all levels of office. You know, he got some initial endorsements from members of the House and a few others, but that's really, he's really stagnated there. You know, if he were really presenting a persuasive case, I think you'd see people coming out of the woodwork to endorse him, you know, every week, and that just hasn't happened yet. And so part of me really does wonder where, you know, at the end of the day, you know, is Bush just not the candidate that can really provide a persuasive case to the moderates in the party, to the social conservatives, to the Chamber of Commerce, to all the different factions within the party? And I think he's got a lot of work to do. I can sort of see why playing the long game might be smart, but on the other hand, you know, if he really is unable to make any dent in the early primaries and caucuses, I think, you know, at a certain point, he's just not going to have enough juice left to actually make this long game strategy work. You know, he might find himself being winnowed out. And I think that's just going to be a testament, not so much to the fact that the Republican Party doesn't want a moderate or, you know, can't nominate a party insider or can't nominate even a Bush. It just may be a fact that for whatever reason, his particular persona and biography was just not the right one at this point in time. It's ironic, too, considering he puts an exclamation mark at the end of his name. You know? And yet, I think, you know, if I were to put a punctuation at the end of his campaign, it would be like a dot, dot, dot. Like, we don't really know yet where this is leading, right? But so, as I said, I think he's a little undervalued at 10%, but I don't think he's a lot undervalued. I still think he's got a long way to climb.
But I'm still trying to think, what was someone smoking when they came up with Jeb can fix it? I mean, oh no, please don't say that. Don't even think that. Don't do that. Don't.
but that's what they're going with. So
I've
late night comedians are having a ball, you know.
I was watching that last Republican debate. Unlike Catherine, I did make it all the way through to the bitter end. And one of the things that I do during the debates, in part to keep myself entertained, is I do watch my Twitter feed. And what I'm doing there is I'm watching the reactions of political observers and reporters, because I'm trying to see kind of conventional wisdom coalesce in real time. And of course, reporters are watching each other's Twitter feeds, and it's really a way for, you could, on a good day you could call it a robust conversation, on a bad day you could call it groupthink, and so I'm struck by the fact that almost, it's very little that Jeb has done since his campaign has started the struggle, whether it's these debates, which are just, I think, not his forte. I mean, I don't think that should be a disqualifying thing for a candidate, but it's true that it's just not his strong suit. As well as that slogan, it's just been hard for him to come up with any piece of sort of campaign wizardry that really strikes people as being interesting or effective. And I think that just makes it hard to change the narrative. And to the extent that political observers and party leaders are following that narrative, I think it's just tough to get a sense that he's really, changing something meaningful about his campaign that's going to give people a different impression.
Are you saying, Doctor, that the die is pretty much cast there for him then?
I don't want to say that yet, and the reason I'm nervous about saying that is because people have, we've counted candidates out before at our peril.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the best case scenario for Bush is John McCain from 2008, where in the mm-hmm. fall of 2007, people were counting him out and sort of snickering that he was carrying his own luggage through the airport in Manchester, New Hampshire, or whatever. And in fact, he actually had enough support within the broader party to make a run when it was actually time for the voters to vote. And we still got, and I know it's hard to imagine, but we still got almost 3 months until Iowa. The campaign
mm-hmm.
is so long. And we've also seen races in recent years where a lot of the dynamics in the race occurred very, very late. So to take one example, Santorum's surge that led to his victory in Iowa didn't come until a few weeks before the primary. Before the caucus. And that wasn't obviously enough to get him a nomination, but still. Obama's surge didn't come until after he won the Iowa caucus in 2008. So, I'm a little bit cautious in to write any candidate out. And this is kind of why I like to talk in terms of percent chance, right? Because at least it sort of says,
mm-hmm.
The chances are never 0% or never 100%, except in the extremes. So,
uh-huh.
as I said, I think 10% undervalues Jeb a little bit, but I don't know that it undervalues him a lot right now.
All right, and with that, I will send it right back to Catherine. Catherine?
Thank you. I just, about Jeb Bush, the thing that I feel he's lacking is I just don't feel any authenticity from him. Like, when I watch him, and I'm sure that I think he's very awkward. I don't think he's comfortable in those debates. I think it's it's not his forte. But I also feel like it's not his way. I mean, he may be very authentic about his interest in being president, but it certainly doesn't come across. And I think people recognize that. And I think that's why one of the reasons that Bernie Sanders is popular is that, what Bernie Sanders is all about. He's very authentic. It's all out there. It might not be everyone's cup of tea, but you can't really say you don't know where he's coming from. And that leads me to my next question.
Yeah.
So last night in the debate, Senator Sanders kept talking about this revolution of young voters and the power of these young people who are supporting him. And, I've been following politics for a long time. I first voted in 1976 for President Carter. And I've seen a lot of these, oh, yeah, the young people are going to come out and vote. The young people are going to come out and vote, and they don't do it. They just don't. I mean, they did for Obama in 2008, but that was a surprise, and I think we all hoped that they would – that this surge of young people would continue to be engaged, and they haven't been. I mean, at least not in the – in the way that we expected. So so if Bernie Sanders does not get the nomination, which I think we all we can't say what's going to happen, but it looks pretty clear that Hillary's going to. Do you think that those young people that he claims to have supporting him will come out if they do come out and vote? Maybe they'll get him the nomination, but are they going to vote for Hillary if he doesn't get the nomination?
That's a good question. My sense is that in the most general sense, voters who are members of a political party who affiliate with a political party, so Democrats in this case, you know, they tend to come around and support whoever the nominee is. Even after a fairly divided or divisive primary. And that's just for the simple reason that, you know, whatever Hillary Clinton's demerits are from the perspective of some Democrats, she's going to look a heck of a lot better when she's running against Marco Rubio or
right.
Ted Cruz or any Republican candidate, you know. So, you know, I think the speculation that we see in every divided primary, like the Republican primary in 2012, you know, the speculation is always, well, you know, can this nominee unify the party? And the answer is yes. You know, we live in an era of extremely strong partisanship where the number of swing voters appears to be dwindling. And for that reason, I think it's reasonable to expect that Clinton can win over these voters when the time comes. I don't think there's a lot of daylight between her and Sanders in terms of what they believe about the issues.
It's true
that Sanders has a different persona. His style and his rhetoric, I think, are different than hers. I'm sure he would point, and maybe she would point to some specific differences on some issues, but I don't think those are fairly small in the broad spectrum of American politics. If I were Sanders, I would agree with you. I would never count on, you know, a vanguard of millennials to catapult me to the nomination. And I would imagine that a lot of those voters will come around to Clinton. And, you know, the question is always, well, will they vote? You know, even if they support her, will they vote? That's absolutely a question. I tend to think that, you know, again, like the presidential campaigns are pretty well positioned to get people to actually turn out and vote, you know, because they have enough money to spend on field organization and the kinds of things that we know that mobilize voters. So, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical at the end of the day that somehow a bunch of liberal 25-year-olds are going to stay home because they don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, but they would have come out to vote for Bernie Sanders. You know, at the end of the day, I don't think that's going to be as consequential as is the broader point, which is that the party will rally around her, even people that were Sanders supporters early on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have a lot of evidence for that. I mean, the in 2004, that was very – there was a lot of divisive politic going on before Kerry won the nomination. As a, you know, devoted Dean follower, I can tell you that. I mean, I really had to hold my nose when I voted for John Kerry, but I did. I mean, I made it – and I took, you know, 10 people with me. I think in 2008 with Senator Clinton and Senator Obama at the time, there was a lot of, you know, snarky back and forth, similar to what we are seeing now with Senator Sanders and Secretary Clinton, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know about your Facebook feed, but mine's filled with, you know, my Hillary people and my Bernie people all, you know, back and forth with each other. With me in the middle saying, okay,
yep.
Whoever's the nominee, I'm voting for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the example of the Democrats in 2008 is a really important one. You know, if you looked at the way that primary evolved over time, you know, you could, there were really, much as in 2015, I mean, there are very easily visible demographic cleavages within the party, you know, and so you have these older white, maybe more working class voters who are more likely to support Clinton in 2008, and you have these younger, maybe better educated or, you know, more likely to be racial minorities supporting Obama, similar in 2015, where you've got this kind of white, you know, liberal, younger, better educated group supporting Sanders. So you've got these, you know, pretty strong demographic differences. And, you know, at the end of the day, the nature of a presidential campaign is it tends to paper over those differences because you're all united against this common enemy. And it's not to say that Obama maybe didn't lose specific voters, you know, who might have voted for Clinton in some parts of the country. I mean, you all are probably familiar, since, of course, this is a program located in the South, and I'm from North Carolina, so I know this area too. You know, there were parts of the South where the Democrats lost votes in 2008, 2012, relative to what they had under Clinton, let's say, Bill Clinton. So those are maybe some white voters that left the party, or at least left Barack Obama. But on the other hand, he gained some voters that he might not otherwise have had. And so that's the thing about a candidate like Clinton in 2015, 2016. I mean, maybe there is a few voters that she might lose, you know, to a candidate like Sanders, people that will never come around and vote for her. But there might be voters that she would gain that would be a little bit reluctant to vote for a candidate that, you know, calls himself a socialist. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's really hard to say for sure that, like, you know, you're really on balance actually at risk of losing voters if you're Hillary Clinton and you've got a challenge in Bernie Sanders. At the end of the day, you know, it might be a wash, and you might be just as well as you would have done had he done
yeah.
at all.
Okay, I'm going to send it back to David to close us out, I guess, it looks like.
Yes, well, Dr. Sides, one quick thing. You alluded to the swing voter project and how it's dwindling. You wrote a post on the Washington Post. I believe you've done some research. Give us just the quick overview of your research there.
Sure. So this actually is research by a Michigan State political scientist named Corman Smith, and he wrote this piece called Polarization and the Decline of the American Floating Voter. And a floating voter is the same thing as a swing voter. It's a voter that might float between the parties or swing between the parties, you know, from election to election to election. Now, we've always had pretty powerful partisanship in American politics, but even back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, there was something like 10 or 15% of the American electorate that you could say was swinging back and forth. And that's dwindled to about 5%, right? So it's a pretty sharp decline. And, you know, the thing that he argues that's happened is that the two parties have increasingly taken different positions on the issues. The Republicans have become more consistently conservative, and the Democrats have become more consistently liberal. And again, this is actually a story that has a lot to do with the South, right, where you don't have these conservative Democrats anymore. And to some extent, it's a story of the Northeast, where you don't have these liberal Republicans. And he's arguing that basically what this does is it makes the choice between the two parties increasingly clear. And he shows that over time people have become more and more aware that there's a difference between the two parties. And what's most striking is that you can actually look at people who are not that attentive to politics. And these people now perceive that there's as much of a difference between the two parties as people who were political junkies back in, like, say, 1965. So in some sense, even the less informed people today have views similar to the best informed people of the 1960s. That just shows you how much the difference between the two parties has penetrated the electorate and how well people perceive that. And that's just because they perceive that difference, that's just made people more consistently partisan, less ambivalent about the two parties. And as a consequence of that, it's just left a smaller and smaller number of people that are genuinely up for grabs. So in his argument is the implication for that is a kind of politics that I think has become more familiar to us in the last several election cycles. It's a politics in which candidates are maybe focused first and foremost on mobilizing their partisan base, and maybe, you know, secondarily on appealing to swing voters. And so that's, you know, the implication then is that's what we should see in 2016.
Yes. Well, I thank you for that answer and for being on the Kudzu Vine this evening. And it's been, like I said, too long since the last time, so we're not going to take as near long a break if you're willing to come on in the future.
I'd be delighted to do that. Thank you again for having me.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Dr. John Sides of George Washington University and the Monkey Cage on the Washington Post. And, guys, Tim, you're keeping time. I take it that's the end of our show, correct?
Yeah, we just went into the extra time right now. So.
Overtime. All right. Good evening, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Next week.